I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is the life of Erica Huggins. Erica Huggins was a member of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, who was arrested and jailed as part of a COINTELPRO plot, which was organized by the FBI. And during her time in prison, she engaged in new spiritual practices to take care of herself and used that experience to further her political platform and her advocacy work, which started long before her time in prison and continued long after her imprisonment as well. Should note that Erica Huggins is still alive. She is 78 years old and continues to be a very strong and notable activist in the United States. And she is the subject of a new book by Mary Frances Phillips entitled Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins, in which Mary uses interviews with Erica, but also uses archival sources that had not been accessed before, things like prison records, letters, photographs, FBI records, to tell this story. And while it is a biography in which Mary had access to Erica Huggins, it's not an as told by, it's nothing like that. It is very much a wonderful profile of Erica Huggins' life, her time and contributions to the Black Panther Party, gets into the perception of the Black Panthers, the reality versus perception out there in the world, and also how Erica Huggins serves as an example, or you can take what she did in her life and use it as a toolkit for activists here in 2025. It's a really powerful book, really well done. And I was very pleased that Mary had some time to talk with me, to talk about the book, talk about the process, and to talk about Erica Huggins' life. And it's a conversation that I very much enjoyed. Think you will as well. So let's get right to my chat with Mary Frances Phillips. All right. And Mary Frances Phillips joins me now to talk about Black Panther Woman. Mary, how are you today?
I am well. I'm well. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm very excited to have you here to talk about the book. Congratulations on the book. Always exciting when new things come out. So just to get us started, let's talk about why this book. What was the story of Erica Huggins and how did you first encounter her and her story?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. So I first learned about Erica Huggins actually when I was pursuing my PhD at Michigan State University. I was a graduate student, always been interested in the Panthers. It was much broader, my topic at the time, on the Panthers, but I was presenting my research work at my from my classes at academic conferences. And I happened to be on a panel, on a conference panel with a lot of the scholars that I was using in my paper. So I was excited. I was nervous, the whole thing when you're a young graduate student. And one of the scholars, Ansel LeBlanc Ernest, put me aside and just said, hey, and she ended up becoming my mentor at the time. And we developed a relationship. And over time, she said to me, hey, you should meet Erica Huggins. I had never heard of Erica Huggins. And she connected us, and our first conversation on the phone, actually, I learned about her incredible story about how she became a Panther, how long she was a Panther, what led her to becoming a Black Panther Party member. And I was very moved by her story. I was very moved by what she offered. It was something about her work as director of the Oakland Community School that was the Black Panther Party's final or one of their longest serving community survival programs. I was moved by the way she told stories and just her everyday experiences in a party. I ended up writing my dissertation on her, and another Panther member, but the book looks at her life in multiple areas, but one area looks at her and the way she survived prison. She was incarcerated for a crime she didn't commit for 2 years. And she turned towards what I call these spiritual wellness practices to get through prison and to come out with her mind, body, and soul intact. And that's not something I dealt with in a dissertation. And those kind of resistance strategies and bridging spiritual practices with the political is a story that is very unknown.
The stereotypical image that I think if people close their eyes and say, who is a Black Panther? You see a Black man with the leather coat. So is this part of a broader erasure of women in the archival record, or just generally not including women who were part of the Black Panthers and part of that movement in the story more broadly?
Well, I think it's both, right? Because there is a lot of gaps in the archival when we look at the archival records per se. For example, there is not one university that holds all the records of Erica Huggins. There is, the Janet Warbit collection, who was Erica Huggins' lawyer, the Janet Warbit collection of Erica Huggins that is at Yale University. However, outside of that, right, there's no like one university that has just Erica Huggins records. You find pieces of her life across all of these universities. You know, if you look in the Black Panther Party newspaper, many universities have digital, have these newspapers digitally, right? And many have hard copies of them as well as, for example, Stanford University has the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton's records, and there's a lot of material in there on Erica Huggins. But it's no place that's just right, exclusively Erica Huggins. So there is a lot of gaps in the archive. So there's times when I had to use oral history. I had to turn to my living source for information that only she knew about her life, because it has not been documented. One, two, is not in the archives at all, right? And so there is more and more scholarship that is really centering the lives and experiences of Black Panther Party women that is doing, you know, really important work in telling these stories. But to tell this biography on Erica Huggins, I had to, you know, push the traditional ways that I've been trained as a historian, really be creative in my approach because of the historical gaps in the archive.
And I was going to ask you about some of the obstacles that you faced in finding archival sources. You've mentioned a bunch of them. I'm curious, in getting oral histories from people, and especially given the subject matter, was there stuff that she didn't want to talk about, or things that stories she didn't want to share with you?
Of course. As I imagine that would be the case for anyone, you know, in many regards. But yes, absolutely. Because we're talking about a Black Panther Party veteran. We're talking about a former political prisoner. And so much of her past is still with us. You know, so I constantly negotiated, you know, times where Erica wanted to keep that privacy. So it was a balancing act a delicate balancing act in the way I told the story. You know, there are some stories that remain, but then there's some stories per her request that she wanted me to cut for whatever reason that was. I think the biggest challenge we had, right, is times where we saw things differently. And what I mean by that is where there was a different understanding, an analysis in how she saw her life and my analysis as a trained historian, right? Because the book is not as told to, right? It's my historical analysis of her life. And at times that ran counter to how she saw her life. And so there was moments where it was, that's why I say it was a delicate kind of balancing act, right?
let's get into a bit of her story specifically. So for those who don't know, and presumably if you haven't read the book yet, based on everything we've talked about, you might not know who Erica Huggins is if you haven't read the book yet. So who was or who is Erica Huggins, and what is her background that she becomes affiliated with the Black Panthers?
Yeah, so Erica is one of the longest serving women members of the organization. She's a poet. She's a former political prisoner. She first started, well, this is kind of her story into joining the Black Panther Party. She was a student at Lincoln University. And she was very involved in student political organizing. She was a part of student groups. She's kind of finding herself during that age, right? This is the moment of Black power, right? So you got Stokely Carmichael and Charles D. Hamilton, who are doing listening sessions of their book, Black Power. She's attending that. So she is really, this is kind of part of her political blossoming, if you will, during this stage. And she comes across a Rampart magazine at the time that had a picture of Huey P. Newton strapped to a hospital gurney, right? And it's telling the story of Huey P. Newton and Officer Frey and Huey P. Newton, you know, being charged, you know, and that whole, I don't want to go down that route. But she read that story. She was so moved by the story. So he was charged with killing a police officer. He actually didn't kill a police officer. And she got so moved by the story and the image that she decided to leave Lincoln University, drive with her lover at the time, John Huggins, drive across country from Pennsylvania to California and join the Black Panther Party, immediately going to work. So she's selling Panther newspaper. She's keeping watch of the Black Panther Party office, right? When she gets pregnant, not that long after she joined, she is still, like, pregnancy did not stop the work of what it meant to be a Black Panther Party member. She essentially was involved in every aspect that you can think of when it came to those community activities. And what I mean by that, she was part of the Black Panther Party newspaper at one point. Of course, every Panther member had to sell Panther newspapers. And this was before she started to join the newspaper cadre, which she joined after she got out of prison. So again, after she, you know, was in the LA chapter for quite a while, there was, most people know about what happened on the campus of UCLA with John Huggins and Bunchy Carter and the role of the FBI in their assassinations and infiltrating Lana Karinga's US organization and exacerbating tensions between the organization and on the campus of UCLA, John Huggins' partner, I mean, Erica Huggins' partner, John Huggins, and her comrade, apprentice Bunchy Carter, were assassinated by the FBI.
For the context of that, in that era, because this is something, I'd certainly in Canada, we don't learn too much about this era in California, but I've always got the sense in the limited stuff I've read is that there's this mix of that the Black Panthers are doing community outreach, right? They're doing like breakfast programs and lunch, like that kind of stuff, right? Ensuring that people have food to eat and like trying to bring community together. But there is like a militant aspect to it as well. But how much of that perception maybe that I have is based off of what the police are doing and the way that the discussion is being framed around the Black Panthers by law enforcement and political leaders?
Yeah, so I think the majority of that, right? I think of the Panthers as revolutionary activists that are literally serving their community. So they have these community programs. Most people know about the free breakfast program, but there were well over a dozen community programs, everything from a free ambulance service that they had for members in the community. They had a free pest control. They had a free clothing program. They had a program that was designed for senior citizens, Seniors Against a Fearful Environment, where they provided transportation, you know, for senior citizens to cash their checks or to go get groceries or what have you. They had a free pest control. They had a program where you can, if you had a loved one that was incarcerated, they would provide you with free transportation. And so many of these, there was free healthcare clinics. They did sickle cell anemia testing. So many of these community programs of the Panthers are oftentimes left out of the public telling of the organization. And oftentimes they were attacked by the police, right? COINTELPRO, you think about the FBI, you think about J. Edgar Hoover, they saw them as a threat, right? And so much of their efforts was to destroy the Panthers by any means necessary when they are literally trying to serve their community, right? Mind, body, and soul. And so I would argue that much of that construction, you know, when they're casted as this kind of militant, angry group, is really a construction of the media. They were about defending and preserving Black humanity. They were about serving poor and oppressed communities, you know, across the nation, across the world. And that is lost. That gets lost by the media, you know?
Right. Does it boil down to just the visual of when you see images of, again, photos aren't always accurate, but a lot of the people who they put on TV or in photographs seem to be like bigger men, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea of a bunch of big, strong Black men on the front lines of the community, even if they're doing community service, is that just a framing device that is used like, oh, this is a threat because of the way in which African Americans have been portrayed in the media for 300 years? Like, I'm just curious about how, where there is community service, where there is this desire to serve people, just how it can be framed in such a negative way and a threatening way that people in the community, like people who aren't in the Black community, are looking at them as a threat.
Well, what's so interesting is that when I see images in the news of the Panthers, I very rarely see when the Panthers were feeding children, when the Panthers were, you know, literally helping residents cross the street, right? Because there was no stoplights. When they were at the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School and they're literally teaching, right, the students that attended the school. When they were doing the sickle cell anemia testing, these are not the images that we see. We right. oftentimes are seeing exactly what you describe, right? And that is Black men with guns. We don't even see women often, right, who were also on the, you know, on the front lines doing the work. The majority of the Black Panther Party at a particular time in the history of the organization was women, right? Most people don't even know that, right? And so the media did a really good job, right, in really trying to destroy the legacy of the organization, try to push this kind of threatening idea in the minds of the public about the Black Panther Party. And it doesn't tell the full story or a broader story of the organization, right?
So you mentioned COINTELPRO plots. So broadly speaking, what were they? How were they organized? And what was the one that was targeting Erica specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, the J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, this is a system designed to destroy the lives of political activists that are doing the work to help build, support, and mobilize their community and provide their community with basic necessities that we all need to survive. And so part of destroying the lengths and the extreme measures that COINTELPRO, that was COINTELPRO, that they put into place, is you see all of these levels of violence, everything from arresting Black Panther Party members who were selling newspapers to downright just assassinating members, which happened to John Huggins and Apprentice Bunchy Carter and many others, right? To charging them with creating offenses that wasn't even real offenses, to literally following and orchestrating and tapping their phones, right? And so, you know, publishing lies about the organization to the media, right? And so the level of extreme measures to really kill this organization and many other organizations played a big part in the destruction of the Black Panther Party.
And so Erica gets targeted by one of these plots. So what was she charged with, and what does she, what is the charge that ends up with her going to prison?
So when she gets to, so after John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, this is in 1969, get assassinated by the FBI. She goes to bury John Huggins' body in his hometown of New Haven, Connecticut. The community comes to her and say, hey, would you be open to starting a Black Panther Party in Connecticut, a Black Panther Party chapter branch? And so she goes and she does that. The plotting from the FBI, the tracking of the FBI continues because Erica is a target, right? And the organization in and of itself, right? And so months later, there becomes an infiltrator in the organization and really causes chaos in the organization, paranoia, I'm talking about in a particular chapter, and a Panther who's a real Panther, right? Not an FBI infiltrator, gets killed by an FBI member who they don't know is an FBI member at the time. And Erica gets charged with murder, conspiracy, and kidnapping to commit murder. And this is how, and because of the kind of patriarchy that was in that particular chapter and who was in that house, essentially, she was forced to do things that, you know, and what I mean is record the torture of Alex Rackley. And it was that recording that led her to end up in court and get those charges against her. And so she ends up getting incarcerated for 2 years, and it ends up being a mistrial, and she does end up getting her freedom, but she ends up on trial with Bobby Seale.
So the book talks a lot about her experience in prison and practicing self-care and this spiritual journey of sorts that she goes on while she is incarcerated. So first off, just a practical question, given the circumstances of her incarceration, that member of the Black Panther Party is a target of the FBI, how did she find time just practically in prison to practice self-care? What were the sort of things that she was doing while incarcerated to engage in these practices?
Yeah. So Erica was considered a political prisoner with, along with the other Panther women that she was incarcerated with, and they were separated from those in the general population, right? They were placed in a separate ward, in administrative isolation. And Erica knew that she needed to go deep inside herself. She knew she needed to do that kind of internal healing work. And she went to one of the lawyers on her legal team, Charles Gary, who was a yoga expert. He used to do headstands before he would go, you know, into the courtroom. So she knew who to go to. And so she asked him for a book on yoga and meditation, and he provided her one. And she studied that book. She self-taught herself yoga and meditation. And she would do it when time permitted every single day, getting no longer than 30 minutes because her time is not her own. And part of her motivation to do that was because her daughter, her young infant daughter, John Huggins' mother, would bring her daughter, Mai Huggins, to see her once a week on a Saturday for an hour. And she wanted to be fully present, fully engaged while she was spending time with her daughter. She didn't want to be broken. She didn't want to be sad. She didn't want to be wilted, if you will. And so that was her motivation that sustained her, that kept her going while she, you know, to keep her doing yoga and meditation. And she didn't want to internalize the hostile environment, the violent environment that she was in during her incarceration. And so,
So was that a continuation of a journey or things that she had done before? You mentioned that she got the book from the lawyer, but were there elements in her life that were spiritual, that were meditative before she was incarcerated?
So in the book, I document her spiritual origins. You know, I go way back to her childhood. I tell a story in the opening of the book when she's a young child and she's looking in the mirror and she's looking deep in her eyes and she's saying, you know, I see something. I see something there. And she's basically saying, I see something deeper than what the outside is, right? And so she's, you see that early understanding that, you know, there is power in the unseen and there's something deep inside me that is very, very powerful. And so it really charts her early spiritual journey. And so, you know, in addition to, I talk about her early beginnings with poetry. I see that as a part of her spiritual practice as well, you know, and so those seeds are there. So when it kind of comes to its full consciousness, when she's incarcerated, she's able to do that because it was already there earlier in her life.
And you mentioned she has a young daughter at this time that she's incarcerated. How did she navigate motherhood? You mentioned she got to spend time with her daughter once a week, but obviously 1 hour a week is not a lot of time to really be present with your daughter, to be a parent. How did she navigate the struggle of being separated and just the overall challenges of motherhood in that environment?
Well, keeping herself as well as she could, being fully present with her daughter, when she was able to spend time with her daughter, was really, really important. When she got her freedom, she immediately went to get her daughter from her mother-in-law and, you know, wanted to build that bond even more so. But Erica would tell you that she didn't always get it right. You know, for Erica, serving the people, the movement was critically important. And sometimes that took a sideline. Right. Once she got out of prison, doing the everyday political work, motherhood, I should say, took a sideline at times to what it meant to be a full-time Black Panther Party member serving your community. So it was definitely a balancing act that she was working to do the best she could.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know many parents who say that they got it right 100% of the time, independent of the circumstances, right? So it doesn't surprise me for her to say that she didn't feel like she always got it right, because I don't think that parent exists anywhere in the world. But in addition to that, how did being a mother influence her experience more broadly, whether that's with the authorities, whatever public attention she got from other Black Panther members? Did her being a mother alter any sort of perceptions or experiences that she had throughout this time in her life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think she, you know, she was incarcerated with other mothers. And so when she was building, you know, like I talked about the building she did with the work of an organization she started while she was incarcerated, the Sister Love Collective. You know, I think she was able to have a certain empathy, level of empathy and compassion for those young mothers, for women that were pregnant. And in fact, some of the Panther women that she was incarcerated with, they were not, of course, if you can imagine, they were not treated well. They were not given the proper prenatal medication and care that they were supposed to be given. And so, you know, she and other Panthers, as well as other women she was incarcerated with, used their body and would stage food strikes as a way to protest the lack of prenatal care that those young mothers were being treated. She would write letters, to the journalists. Can you connect, you know, this particular woman, for example, is not doing well. She is pregnant. Can you get her prenatal clothes? Here are her sizes. She is in need of her family. Can you reach out to her family and have her family come visit her? You know, so Erica, she understood. And then also at this time, you know, you had these stereotypes about Black women, about Latino women that were very demeaning. So oftentimes prison officials looked at them as unfit mothers, mm-hmm. and would, you know, write these stereotypes about Black women kind of on their body, if you will, in the way that they treated them and the kind of violence that they experienced because they saw them as unfit mothers. And so, you know, they are literally fighting for their humanity and fighting for their rights to be a mother, even through incarceration. When Erica was incarcerated, she was breastfeeding. And so one of the things that the prison officials did was give her pills to stop her from lactating. And it was very demoralizing, and it was painful to be forced to have to do that, right? And so, you know, they're literally fighting for their life, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier that she gets out of prison after 2 years and gets her freedom again. Before we talk about sort of what the rest of her life looks like, does that connection, the community she builds in prison while incarcerated, does that continue? The women that she meets, the mothers, like how does she forge that community that is built in that moment? And does that carry with her once she gets her freedom again?
So she formed the Sister Love Collective with a young Puerto Rican sister who was 16 years old at the time. Erica was 21. And one of the first things that they did was form a hair salon. It was a way to feel good, right? It was a way to reaffirm your femininity. It was a way to push back to the prison's intentional way to strip you of your femininity. And so she would meet, you know, other women, you know, while doing the kind of hair care sessions, if you will. So they would use their commissary to get whatever they need. And some of these women she only saw once. But through that exchange was storytelling and the power of storytelling, and she learning what everyone needs and figuring out ways to fulfill. They might need a lawyer, or, you know, they, you know, all kinds of stuff that they are in need for. I mean, and so all of these other services came out of the work of the Sister Love Collective. For example, they had a women's bail fund that came out of that. And so, you know, if you're about to get out of prison, she would make sure that you had transportation, you know. And so it became a pivotal group. You know, women that were on heavy drugs, for example, the prison had a very demeaning way that they would try to get you off a particular drug, which was cold turkey. Hmm. So they would the women in the Sisters of Love believe candy or cigarettes ease the pain and withdrawal. And so they would smuggle cigarettes and candy, because oftentimes when these women are going through withdrawal, they're separated, you can't communicate with them or what have you. So they would smuggle candy or cigarettes if the women smoke cigarettes to help ease the pain. And when the women came out of that process, you know, they would send a, you know, when they delivered, they would send a little note from the Sister Love. And so they would thank them or what have you. And so the organization changed lives, right? Mm-hmm. It did not sustain itself. It was underground, right? It wasn't formalized. They're doing this in plain sight in front of the correctional officers. All this revolutionary work, and the correctional officers have no idea what is going on, right? And the kind of revolutionary work that they're doing, right? They're redesigning their prison uniforms, right? And so all kinds, they're doing all this kind of mentorship work as well. And so because it was because it wasn't formally organized, when the women got their freedom, it was very difficult to sustain it. Right. And so, yeah.
Yeah. The best type of resistance always happens in plain view of the authority, right? Like the authority figure, that's always the best type of resistance. So you mentioned that it's difficult to sustain this organization as people are getting out of prison. So what is the transition back to freedom like for Erica, and what does her life look like post-incarceration?
Yeah. So she, you know, immediately when she got her freedom, she went to get her daughter, and she got right back to work with the Black Panther Party. So one of the first things she did was work for the Black Panther Party newspaper. So she's collecting stories, she's writing stories. And then over time, she became the director of the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School, their elementary level institution, first working as a teacher at the school and then moving and kind of ascending and becoming director of the school, in charge of really managing the school. She's the spokesperson of the school. She's traveling. And so that work and doing, so a lot of the practices that helped sustain her while she was incarcerated, she brought to the children of the Oakland Community School. So they're doing yoga. They're meditating, right? They're engaged in what I consider, they didn't use this word at the time, but restorative justice practices, right? To talk through conflict and to work through their differences when there's harm being done, or, you know, when a student isn't doing their homework, right? And so they're teaching them all of these kind of leadership skills at the same time at the school. The school was well ahead of itself in the kind of innovative revolutionary practices that they were doing. In the 80s, once the school closed, you know, over time, Erica started working during the HIV/AIDS pandemic. She's working as an educator during this time. She's working as an activist, doing a lot of educational awareness and talking with individuals who have HIV/AIDS, who are battling chronic illnesses. And so Erica wanted to be an educator her whole life, right? And so she was finally able to pursue that, right, when she got her freedom.
So obviously this is a very full, very rich biography that we've really only just kind of scratched the surface of the entirety of Erica's story here. So definitely encourage people to go look at the book, read the book to get the real fulsome story here. But another aspect that comes up in the book is that it can serve almost as a toolkit for contemporary activists, and lessons can be learned from Erica's story. So for you as the historian working on this project, the author of the book, obviously, what are some of the ways in which the book serves as that toolkit, and how can activists learn from Erica's story and incorporate it into their own work?
She gives us a blueprint of how to heal from within. When you are at your lowest, she teaches us what it means to tend to your inner self, what it means to do, to build community to do this. She bridges the political with the spiritual. And that is powerful when you are living in a world as a person that is, you know, part of a marginalized identity, in a world that wasn't designed for your survival. if you will. And so in blending spiritual and political practices, it is a tool that is ever so needed today in these political times. But it allows you to understand how the spiritual and the political are intricately important and what it means to heal from our past trauma, right? While also doing the community work, because you have to heal from within to be able, once you do that, you're able to give more of yourself to your community and doing the political work in our community. But, you know, Erica helps us understand that that work that we are doing for ourselves to help us really heal is political and is just as important, right?
Very well said. And that's why we encourage people to check out the book. So again, it is Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins. Mary, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, keep track of everything else you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
So it is literally available in every, pretty much every outlet out there. I would encourage you to go to your local bookstore and support your local bookstore and pick it up from there. It's also on an audio version of it available as well for folks to purchase.
Nice. We love that. We will link down below to where you can get a copy of the book. And as I said, encourage you to do so. Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins. Mary Frances Phillips, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I had a great time.
So there you have it, my chat with Mary Frances Phillips. And I thank her for her time. Once again, Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which today comes from KQED, which is the NPR PBS member for Northern California. The article entitled "How the Black Panthers Shaped U.S. Schools" by Amanda Font from November 14, 2024. And this article provides some further context to what Mary was talking about during our conversation, that the perception that I think a lot of people have, or the image in people's head of the Black Panthers, would be large Black men in leather jackets carrying guns. But this article goes into details about the role they played in a lot of local schools. In fact, it's an interview. It's a transcript of an interview that is done on an NPR station that includes clips from Erica Huggins herself. So you can hear Erica Huggins in her own words. It's obviously edited. It's not a live interview or anything like that, but it's a kind of a documentary piece, and it has the full transcript of how this was put together. Just to give you a sense of some of the work that the Black Panther Party was doing in Northern California in schools that doesn't necessarily get the top line coverage that you always think about, and certainly in the images and the things that you learn about, and or at least I'll say that I learned about in a lot of survey classes. So certainly would recommend that to you. Get the firsthand voice of a lot of folks who were there in the schools doing advocacy work at the time. So today's historical headline of the week from KQED, the NPR PBS station out in Northern California, by Amanda Font, "How the Black Panthers Shaped U.S. Schools." And with that, I'll say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca, all the great written material over there on the website. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old as news at gmail.com. So I will say thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again real soon with more What's Old Is News.